Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, just last week, another 100 Boston-based companies joined Mayor Marty Walsh in the city's effort to anonymously share and collect payroll data with the hope of using that data to close the income gap between genders. Now, the idea is this: if the city can identify gender-based pay inequities in the data, then that knowledge and transparencies would help them close the gap, as I mentioned. Well, Harvard behavioral economist Iris Bonnet says that's a start, but the real problem is structural and therefore requires structural solutions. What would work better, she argues, are design changes that could remove sexism from the system entirely. Iris Bonnet directs the Women and Public Policy Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and she's also author of the new book, What Works? Gender Equality by Design, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me, Meghna.
So first of all, when we say design in the workplace and how that relates to wages, what exactly do you mean?
Well, let me start maybe with an example. In fact, Boston has been one of the leading places experimenting with design intervention. The Boston Symphony, as well as some other major orchestras in the United States, introduced curtains in the 70s to have their musicians audition behind a screen. So they basically introduced blind evaluations, and it turns out that made them more likely to hire talent rather than people who looked the part. Specifically, it increased the likelihood that they hired women by about 50%, increasing the share of women on our major orchestras from about 5% in the 70s to now almost 40%.
Because they were simply listening to the music and the quality of play versus who
was exactly right.
It.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And a curtain is a design, right? This has nothing to do with changing mindsets, but has a lot to do with de-biasing how we do things.
Okay, so true, a curtain is a design, but a decision had to be made in order to incorporate that design. I mean, were they doing that specifically because they recognized they had a problem with who they were hiring and how?
That is actually right, yes. Not specifically about women only, but they were concerned that they might be racist or sexist and wanted to see what difference the curtain made.
Okay. So go ahead.
Interestingly enough, Phil, it wasn't the orchestra directors who thought that this would make a difference. They were very convinced that they, of all people, only listened to the music and certainly didn't pay attention to what people looked like.
Okay, so this gets to the point that you're making, that actually de-biasing people is very, very hard because I guess, as you just pointed out, most of us don't think we're biased.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's also liberating in a way, though, because this is about all of us. It's not pointing fingers at the bad people who do bad things, but it is pointing fingers basically at our mindsets and kind of saying, you know, this is just how we're built. And so let's just make it easier for our biased minds to get things right.
So are we creatures who are so responsive to our environment that we can change things like wage gaps and who we hire simply by how we go about the process?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to argue in the book, and I provide actually quite a bit of evidence suggesting that. And it's not just blind evaluation. I mean, there's more that we can do, particularly in our talent management. And it starts with how we advertise. I mean, what kind of words do we use in our advertisements? What kind of adjectives do we use?
Can you give us some examples?
Absolutely. So, for example, in schools, we have an issue that we don't have enough male teachers. And so let's imagine a school wanted to advertise for male teachers. They certainly shouldn't use language such as looking for a compassionate, caring teacher to work in a supportive work environment, because compassion as well as care as well as support is stereotypically associated with women. And there's research.
But is that not the fault of the men looking at the ad who say that that's not the job for me?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm not going to fault the men, because that's how our minds work. And seeing really is believing. If we don't see male teachers, we don't naturally associate that job with men. Mm. And so in the ad, we really need to pay attention to be inclusive and use inclusive language that speaks to everyone.
Okay, so the way we word job postings, what about, you know, I'm still taken by your symphony example.
Yeah.
How would a job interview in a more sort of conventional corporate setting work, because you can't put the person behind a screen when you're interviewing them for a management position, can you?
Well, I actually argue that you can at early stages of the interview process. And in fact, a number of companies are doing that now, blinding themselves to the names and sometimes even to the complete resume of a job applicant. And instead, what they're using are work sample tests, which test basically some of the skills that you look for in a future hire. And, you know, a big myth that I kind of have to debunk here is the validity of the interview. So there's tons of research showing that unstructured interviews are probably the worst predictor of future performance. Mm. And we cling on to them because all of us believe that, of course, we are particularly good at doing this.
Doing this in terms of like reading what the interview is saying and judging their merits based on how and what they say?
Yeah, just looking at you, I feel that you are right for this job. And that's what people actually, when you interview interviewers and ask them, you know, what they look for, they will literally say, oh, no, I heard that he or she shares the same hobby. Therefore, the person must be a great engineer.
Okay, so we can do things like maybe take a lot of the structural bias out of the interview process. But what happens when the person actually gets hired? Because it's typically after that the salary negotiation begins, and then you know who the person is. You know their gender, you know their background, you know their race, you know all sorts of things about them. How do you, I mean, we started this conversation by talking about the gender wage gap. Mm-hmm. How do you bridge the gap once the anonymity is gone?
Yeah. So I'm super excited by Boston collaborating with a number of institutions, including the Women in Public Policy Program, on increasing wage transparency and decreasing ambiguity really from negotiations. And that's what research actually shows, that it helps women a lot if they have a sense of what's negotiable, what's on the table, because women more so than men violate gender norms by even asking, and certainly by asking assertively. So making this whole kind of negotiation dance more transparent for women is very, very exciting. But, you know, I mean, you're basically asking also about the career ladder, mm-hmm. you know, because as you rightly point out, one of the big challenges that we're up against is the lack of women in leadership positions. And so I do spend quite a bit of time thinking about performance appraisals, for example. And there are two, I think, relatively low-hanging fruit that most organizations could implement kind of tomorrow. One is that many organizations ask their employees to self-evaluate and self-rate before they share these evaluations with their managers. So managers see how a person evaluated themselves. And if men, for example, are more self-confident than women, and there's lots of evidence suggesting that that is true, men will give themselves higher ratings than women, and that will anchor or bias their managers. Mm-hmm. So do away with sharing of self-evaluations.
Do away with sharing. Okay. Well, what about just even the idea of performance evaluations as a whole? I understand that there's some pushback from certain quarters that there hasn't been any good performance evaluation or perfect performance evaluation invented yet.
Yeah,
the bias is going to creep in somehow.
You're exactly right. But we have to go back to where you started. I think data are actually now quite helpful. At least we now collect more evidence on what's broken. And that's also why I'm excited about what Boston is doing. And, you know, in performance evaluations, what we normally see is that when companies evaluate their employees based on two components, which many do, past performance and future potential, the bias creeps in on potential. Because that's where we fill in the blanks.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I just want to step back for something which we talked about a minute ago, because I'm not quite, I'd love to hear more what you say about this, because the fundamental premise here is that it's hard to change people's minds, mm-hmm. but easier to influence them by changing the environment, right?
Yes.
Both sort of procedurally and structurally. But what about those things that workplaces try to do to change people's minds? Diversity training, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, is all of that for naught?
So sadly enough, what I did find was, I mean, two things about diversity trainings. First of all, we don't measure enough. And that is really the biggest insight. We just throw money at the problem and never really measure what difference it really makes. And then the few places which have measured, which literally have run an experiment, you know, with a treatment group which got the diversity training and the control group which didn't get the diversity training, they found that diversity trainings don't work. Yes, that is a very sad finding.
It doesn't make any change in sort of people's thinking about diversity in the workplace.
And, you know, it goes back to something that many of us strongly believe in, and that is that much of the bias is unconscious, mm-hmm. right? It's even though you and I are aware of it now, in a week from now, we will fall prey to the very same kind of stereotypes again.
Yeah. So finally, I'm curious, I mean, the idea of design changes, whether they be in terms of how we do what we do, or even just the physical design of workspaces, as we've discussed, it's all part of all the rage in behavioral economics right now, of like nudging people without them really knowing that they're being nudged towards new behaviors. Do we have evidence that it's effective, though, that it actually works, that you get not just individual change, but you can get organizational change through these methods?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the title of my book was very purposely chosen, that I almost exclusively rely on experimental evidence that really tries to measure whether something works or doesn't work. And so the kind of, you know, recommendation that I make are based on that assumption. And there are some really, you know, interesting, because you just mentioned the physical environments, there are very interesting experiments, for example, on the portraits on our walls, and that it matters what we see. And it can affect, for example, students' performance on tests, depending on whether they see stereotypical or counter-stereotypical role models on the walls. And so role models are important in kind of the portraits. Harvard, for example, is changing the portraits on our walls because we realized only 11 years ago at the Kennedy School that all of the portraits of leaders on our wall were of men.
And shocker.
Shocker. Well, shocker. But, you know, at least we're counting. So, and that's why I'm such a big fan of measuring. Measuring is really the first step to understand what's broken, and then we can intervene very strategically.
Well, Iris Bonnet is a behavioral economist at Harvard, where she directs the Women in Public Policy program at the Kennedy School of Government. Her fascinating new book is What Works? Gender Equality by Design. Professor Bonnet, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Nika.
And listeners, go to RadioBoston.org and let us know what you think about making structural changes in the workplace to achieve more equity. Again, it's RadioBoston.org. We'd love your comments. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston.